Well, hey, friends. Man, this episode is a good one. You're going to like it. I talk about our experience in Australia. We had a tremendous time, amazing people. I got a lot to tell you, you know, and I didn't even get to say, there's so many little details that, you know, when I got done recording this, I wished I would have put in there. But anyways, it's good enough. And we had a great time. I hope you enjoy this episode. I want to give a shout out to all of our amazing sponsors that make this podcast available to you for free. That would include Western Mule Magazine, Mules and More Magazine. We got Roman Homes, Colt Saddlery, Diamond W Enterprises, and of course, Boyd Ranch Mule Days, which is coming up in March. Better get on there, save your spots. Our clinic is just about full there, so we're looking forward to that. But hey, thank you for listening. Let's get it going. Here you go. Well, hey, friends. Welcome to the Everyday Mulemanship Podcast. I appreciate you being here. As always, I hope you know how grateful I am for each and every one of you. I really appreciate you trying to be a little better, do a little better, be a better muleman, better horseman. And choosing us. Thanks for listening. I can't tell you how thankful I am for you. So we just got back from Australia. I wish I could come back with their accent. They said that I had the accent. So that was up for debate the whole time because I thought they talked funny, but they thought I talked funny. So we'll see. We'll see. We'll have to put it up for a vote. But anyways, we had the best time. I have to say, this was my favorite time going down there. We've been down there 3 times. We went 2018, 2019. We were supposed to go in 20. That didn't work out. We didn't rebook for 21. It's still crazy. 22 didn't rebook. But we made it this year. So, it was awesome. Way too fast of a trip. Holy cow. We flew out on Sunday evening. So pretty much last Sunday, we woke up in the morning, finished packing up, went to church for a couple hours, got out of church about 11, ate lunch, and loaded up the car and dropped off Ellie and Swayze at their grandparents' house. They stayed with Sky's mom and dad. And of course, Ellie wanted to bring her little mini mule, little pony mule, I guess not a mini, a little pony mule, Peppy, and her little mini horse, little pony, Beauty. So we had to drop off truck and trailer and ponies and mule, everything at grandma, grandpa's and the kids. And we said our goodbyes, went to the airport, and pretty much, so we left Sunday. And by the time we got to Australia, it was Tuesday down there because we crossed the dateline. So I think, I don't know, I guess I'd have to do the math real fast in my head, which I'm not going to do, because technically, you know, Australia is way ahead as far as the time goes. But it was easier for us to just say it like this. They were basically 6 hours behind our U.S. mountain time. They were 6 hours behind, but it's tomorrow. So it was kind of fun calling home, calling the girls and telling them we're calling from tomorrow, calling from the future. But anyway, so yeah, basically skipped out on Monday. We got down there Tuesday. The flight was good. It was really easy. The only little glitch we had was we're sitting there in Sydney, Australia at the airport, waiting for our connection to Melbourne. And anyways, the screens, you know, where we were sitting, all of a sudden just changed. So the flight that we were booked on was gone. So we went to the big board where they got all the flights listed. I don't know what that thing is technically called, but the big board with all the flights. And it said canceled by ours. So we're like, oh, crap. Everything was going so smooth. And so we went down to the desk and they had another flight out at 11, but it was already booked. And the earliest they could get us on another flight was like 4:30 that afternoon. And we're like, gosh, I don't want to wait around, sit around here all day. It was the morning. This is like 8:30 in the morning. I'm like, I really don't want to sit around here, but it's not quite enough time to like get a ride over to the beach or something and hang out at the beach in Sydney, which would have been fun. That would definitely have been fun, but it just wasn't quite enough time to do all that. And so anyways, I said, well, let's look up these other airlines. And so, big thank you to Virgin Australia. They got us right on. I said, hey, we need a flight, and booked it and got us right on. We weren't much later than the original flight, and made it to Melbourne and get off the plane. We're heading outside. I'm just following the signs out to where it's telling me to go for public pickup. Anyways, and we're trying to communicate with our wonderful host Pam and John Cash, which is fun for me to say that I'm friends with Johnny Cash. He drove Pam down there to pick us up. And anyways, we were in the wrong area. So we walked back and we found each other. And I just got to tell you, it was so fun. It was just so good to see Pam and John. And you guys, if you've never been to Australia, it's hard to explain how happy the people are. They're really happy people. Like most everybody's just really happy. At least the people we were around, which is also the case for the people that were around here in the U.S. You know, I mean, most of the people that we're around in our line of work, in our life, everybody's pretty darn happy. I mean, we don't have there's not much negativity in my world. There really is not. But down there in Australia, definitely everybody that we were around, super happy. And it was good to see John's big smile and Pam's big smile, give them a hug, said hi, threw our stuff in, and off we went. And I still can't get used to them driving. You know, they drive on the left side of the road. That's just roundabouts totally confuse me down there. And I'm just so glad they picked me up. They picked me and Sky up. We don't have to drive. I didn't have to drive at all this time. I didn't even get behind the wheel, not even once. And I'm so glad, because I'm pretty sure all those roundabouts there in town would really mess me up. Anyway, I told John, I said, hey, I want to buy you guys lunch. I really appreciate you guys picking us up and driving clear down here. I want to buy you lunch. Where do you want to go? Oh, well, there's a place up here. Let me take you this place up here. So we're in Australia, and John, of all the places that we could have went, I'm sure there's cool places to eat. You know, they got a lot, they call them pubs down there. They got a lot of pubs and a lot of good food. And, John takes us to McDonald's. That's what he wants. And I'm not sure, I don't know if John and Joe Cash listened to this podcast, because I think by me telling you that we went to McDonald's, John would actually be in trouble, because I think he's not allowed to go to McDonald's by his lovely wife trying to keep him healthy. But we went to McDonald's, and it was actually, so we never go to McDonald's. I mean, I don't really know the last time we went. I mean, it's pretty rare that we go. It's like for here, you know, in the U.S., you know, McDonald's is just basically survival food. It's like something to eat when there's nothing else and you're desperate. You go for the survival food. Actually, down there, I don't know if McDonald's has changed and just put a bunch of crap in it to make it taste so good, but it was pretty darn good. We also hadn't eaten much other than airport food and plane food, you know, for like 24 hours. So maybe that was why. But yeah, of all the places he wanted to take us in Australia, we go to McDonald's. But sure enough, to my word, I bought him McDonald's. So anyways, I was grateful for John picking us up and for Pam meeting us there at the airport. So they take us up to John's daughter's house. His daughter's name is Jess, and son-in-law, Dan Anderson. So Jess and Dan Anderson are two of the coolest people ever. I feel like, I just feel like I've known them forever, even though they're new friends, but I just love those two so much. And they were so amazing to us. So yeah, John and Pam drop us off down there. We're going to stay at Dan and Jess's house, and they just totally welcome us into their home. Just absolutely, they give us a room, totally welcome us, make us feel super comfortable. I get in their house, and on the counter they have Australia's famous Tim Tams. They call them Timmies down there. If you don't know what a Tim Tam is, you're missing out. Your life is not fulfilled yet. You need to eat a Tim Tam. They're the best cookie ever. And anyways, they had a couple of sleeves of Tim Tams there and different flavors and, you know, Cadbury chocolate, of course, and a bunch of Coke. So a bunch of Coca-Cola. I guess I better be specific here. You know, we got plenty of sugar. it kicked off by us not making wise decisions on food between McDonald's and the chocolate and the Coca-Cola. We were not on the good, healthy train, but it was awesome. I got to say, it was a treat. And, you know, we try to be healthy outside of everything else. So that when some stuff like this comes up, we'll be okay. We'll be all right. But that night, and I'm probably going too fast, I guess, but that night, holy cow, I had my new favorite pizza of all time. And all my friends at home, they're going to be jealous because I've never heard of anybody doing this here in America. You know, and I live down in San Pete County, Utah, where, I mean, this is sheep country. Okay, we got sheep everywhere. And anyways, that first night there in Australia, Jess cooked us up lamb pizza, and holy cow, that was so stinking good. I mean, I haven't had pizza that good. So Jess, that was my favorite pizza of all time. Good job. So good. I need to get all these sheep growers around here to start making some lamb pizza. I think that should definitely be a thing here. But anyway, so yeah, first day in Australia eating, you know, started a little rough with McDonald's, got a little wilder with the Tim Tams and Coca-Cola and Cadbury, and ended with a dang good pizza, lamb pizza. But before dinner time, I got to jump back a little bit because this was definitely my highlight of our Australia trip. And I know I'm not talking a lot of mule stuff yet. I'll get to that. I just got to tell you how fun this trip was. But my highlight down there was for sure fishing in Australia. Dan and Jess, they have a neighbor there, awesome guy. And his name is Brad. I don't remember his last name. And I should give him a shout out because he's got a really cool place. He's got multiple ponds or lakes. I don't know what you call them, ponds, lakes, you know, and a creek running through there. And he outfits fishers. So you can come in there, you can fly fish, you know, bait fish, whatever you're into, spinner fish. And then he's got a couple of cabins there that he rents out. But anyways, it was a blast. And I caught a couple of rainbow trout, bigger than I've ever caught here. Now, yeah, I know they were in a pond and everything, but he does not feed them. They just grow big. And, holy cow, that was really fun. The very first one I caught, reeling it in, bringing it in, you know, with a fly rod, and it gets hung up around some reeds. Of course, we didn't really know yet, but I got it up to the kind of closer, a few feet away from the bank, and it gets hung up in the weeds down there. And anyways, it's caught on something, and I'm sitting there trying to get it in, and this is where Dan became my true friend, because he just takes his boots off, takes his phone out of his pocket and his wallet, and he just jumps in the pond. He just jumps in. And I got a picture that I need to put on social media. I'm sure he'd appreciate it. Of him down in this pond, up to his neck in water. It's pretty deep there, and he's trying to get my line back. And anyways, by the time he got in there, he's pretty sure the fish, you know, got pretty spooked by him and jerked out of there. But my line ended up being wrapped around a reed or a weed, whatever it is, multiple times. It was wrapped around and around and around and around. So that fish, when I brought it in, I must have given it too much slack because it went round and round a weed there. And, you know, by the time Dan got in there to help me out, it was off. But not to be disappointed, because immediately after, just a couple minutes later, another cast, I caught another one, brought it to the bank, and one of the biggest rainbow trout it was the biggest rainbow trout I've ever caught, for sure. And it's just catch and release, of course. So we turned it loose, and a little while longer, I caught another one. It wasn't quite as big as the first one, but it was still just a blast bringing them in there, and just a treat for me to be able to fly fish in Australia. You know, it's been my goal to be able to fish in every state in the U.S., which I actually thought would be easier, and it's not. It's not that easy, because a lot of places we go, there is no water around, or no bodies of water, or anything like that. But that was pretty fun. So, Dan, I know you listen to the podcast, Dan. You know, when you went in for that fish, buddy, you became one of my best friends. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for lining that up. I mean, that was so fun. Although I was, if I'm being 100% honest, I was scared to death the whole time, because Jess and Dan both were getting us riled up about all the brown snakes. They got brown snakes down there, and they got black snakes. And brown snakes are like one of the deadliest in the world. I think one of the black snakes are too. They're very venomous. But anyways, they say they see them there all the time. Right where I brought those fish in, Jess said that she had saw one there just a day or two before. And so definitely on alert. I was definitely on alert. A lot of people think I'm super brave, you know. They're like, oh, wow, because, you know, I'm not really bothered to work with any mule or any horse. And, you know, I guess there's some of them that definitely try me and, you know, and test me, but it really doesn't ever, I don't get riled up at all by horses, mules, nothing. People sometimes rile me up, I guess, make me a little nervous, but, snakes, definitely. Holy cow. You know, you know, no way. And so they said, hey, there's brown snakes everywhere. And if you get bit, like, you're probably just going to die. So don't get bit. And so I was definitely a little tense there for a while, but, it was a good time. And you know, we get back to their house after fishing, and there's kangaroos in the paddock, and that absolutely made Sky's trip. I'm pretty sure that the kangaroos were her favorite part. And I'm not just saying like one or two kangaroos. They had, well, they would say a whole mob of them. And another word they use a lot is heaps. I heard that a bunch down there too. Heaps of them. So there were a lot of kangaroo around there. And they're just out there grazing right out there with the horses, with the mules, with the cows. Dan has a bunch of cows and horses and stuff there. And kangaroo are just out there grazing. If you want to see some pictures of it, Sky has a whole bunch on the social media, Facebook and Instagram. So you can see some of those pictures. Anyways, I feel like we did a pretty good job getting on their schedule, because we've, you know, on the flight over, we kind of forced ourselves to stay awake until like 2 o'clock, you know, our time at home, which was like 8 o'clock, for them. In the evening, you know, and we usually go to bed, you know, around 8 or 9 or 10 here at home anyway. So if we could get on that schedule there, we would be pretty good. And, I feel like I did pretty good at that. So I was feeling good, way better than I have in the past. In the past, I didn't think about that. I did not think about the time, big time change like that. I didn't think about trying to fight that jet lag, but this time, I slept pretty decent on the plane on the way out. We were on the schedule, ready to go. And so, you know, we were able to get up early the next morning, feeling pretty dang good, and had a pretty easy morning there. it was raining a little bit. So we kind of hung out under their beautiful porch they have around their house, watched the kangaroos out there and hung out, and they took their kids to school, and then we loaded up. They don't say loading up the truck and trailer. They say loading up the float, or putting the float on the ute. And so, yeah, it's a ute and a float. It's not a truck and a trailer down there. And I posted a picture of that, right? And I can put another one up there, but you can see what I'm talking about. They don't have a lot of the bigger trucks like we do here in the U.S. So they have these smaller trucks. In the U.S., kind of picture like a Toyota Tacoma size truck, you know, little truck. And that's what they're using to haul typically three horse trailers. They call them floats, like I said. And anyway, so we loaded up. They had a couple of horses, and they, John was gracious enough to bring down one of his mules named Bobo. And you can see a picture of Bobo on social media too. He's a cool mule. They did not cut his mane off for me. So, you know, I had to just humble myself and not let the mane rile me up. Those of you that know the inside joke on this, you're probably laughing right now, but Bobo had quite the mane on him. So you guys know my mules, I'm used to them. I like them clean cut, shaved, and no mane. And Bobo was just letting it fly. Just a crazy mane. So, but he was a cool dude. I really liked riding Bobo. It was funny when we were there, we were trying to figure out how old this mule was. You know, usually, you know, most of you here in the States are used to watching me ride my younger mules. I haul my younger mules around mostly. And, you know, the oldest one that I ride these days is Riata, who to me is still a baby, but you know, I mean, she's going to be turning 9 soon. And I'm not hauling her nearly as much as I used to. So I'm always riding something younger, you know. And we get down there and we're trying to figure out how old Bobo is. And Dan thinks he's 18. He says, well, John says he's about 18. And there's a fellow there, Noel, that had trained Bobo back when he was a colt. And he said, no, you know, because I can't remember the name of the movie, but he's like, no, we use Bobo in this movie. I have to see if I can look it up real quick, this picture of this movie. I don't know if I still have it right here. But he's like, no, Bobo was in this movie, and the movie was, you know, like a long time ago, like 20 years ago. Shoot, I should have had that prepared for you guys. But anyways, the movie's a war movie about Australia and fighting in World War I, I believe, if I got my facts right. Using mules. So Bobo was in this movie, and you know, he's like, hey, he's got to be old, you know. And luckily there was another person there that raised Bobo, and she's like, no, he was born in 2003. So anyways, we figured out Bobo was 20 years old, you know. And I just these days I just don't ride a lot of mules that are 20 years old anymore. Usually I'm riding something that's, you know, younger. So it was kind of fun to ride Bobo, and he did a great job. That mule, even at 20, he has a lot of just raw talent. You know, and I was telling Dan and Jess, you know, a lot of things that, you know, just kind of work on some of this stuff. And this mule, you know, he could be really good. And you know, Dan kind of explained, you know, well, he just gets ridden by a lot of dudes, you know. And you know, the truth of it is nobody's really going to work on him. Like, you know, when you come use them in the clinic, you're the only one working on it. And, you know, it might sound funny, but no matter what, I'm always trying to improve, you know, whatever I'm doing. I'm trying to get better at riding all the time myself. I'm trying to be a better rider, trying to be a better muleman, better horseman. And if there is a mule involved in that, I'm going to try to get it better too. So even though I know maybe Bobo is not going to go on to, you know, nobody's really going to go on and work on him a whole lot. He's just going to kind of get used. That's okay. But I'm going to try to leave him a little better Then I found him. And, you know, I asked Dan, I said, I'd like to know what Kaylee, he has a daughter named Kaylee, thinks about this mule, because right after the clinic, they had a, what do they call it? They had a, like a pony club show down there. And Kaylee was going to be using him in the pony club show. And so I said, just ask her when she's done riding him that day, if you know, how he felt, like if he felt any different, if he felt anything better. And, you know, he did say that she noticed a difference. He didn't say a whole lot, you know, into that more. Maybe he was just kind of being nice. I don't know. Maybe she's like, oh yeah, he ruined Bobo. No, but, I'm always trying to leave something a little bit better. So it was amazing, you know, just working on an older mule like that, you know, because, you know, at this point I can see where so many habits get developed. And I know a lot of you out there, you're riding stuff that maybe is a little older. Maybe it's in their teens. Maybe it's, you know, in their early 20s. And it's easy to kind of get in the rut thinking, well, you know what, they're just older and they are what they are. You know, what's the point of trying to change them now? But I'm here to tell you, it's never too late to improve for human or for mule or for, you know, for horse or donkey or anything. It's never too late. A lot of you have heard me share this on the podcast before, but, you know, my great grandpa, you know, I heard him, he told me one time, you always keep learning, you know, when you think you know it all, it's time to die. You know, that's a little rough, but, keep learning, all the time. And so, yeah, I applied that to Bobo while I was down there, and I had fun riding him. You know, he actually had a pretty good little turnaround. Like he'd get over on his hock pretty good and, you know, turn on the haunches pretty decent. And so I played with that quite a lot. And, there's just some little things that you can tell that it's just a routine and they kind of know the drill or they want to hurry. You know, I would work on opening the gate. I'd ride over there and I'd open the gate to go in the arena every day. And you can tell he just wanted to hurry through it. Like, hurry, open the gate, go through. And, you know, like when I'm working on opening a gate, I will work on riding up to the gate and then I stand still and I have him wait. And then I unlatch the gate and I just hold it open and I still continue to stand still because they can get, you know, it's funny. A lot of them get broke to sound. Like they'll hear the gate latch or the chain or they'll hear a noise. And that will trigger a response, you know, and this is how we teach them, you know, verbal commands, right? Well, they can do the same thing. So they hear that chain or that gate latch and all right, time to go through the gate and they get pushing on you. That happens. So I'll unlatch it and I'll wait. And then I'll move the hips over, kind of open the gate up a little bit. A lot of times when they see the gap, they want to shoot through it. So I have them wait there. And then I'll ride up the gate and I have them wait there. Then I side pass, leg yield type thing over to shut the gate. And I wait there. And then I back up a little, latch the gate and I wait there. And I don't just ride off after it's shut. I just wait. And when I'm working on all these things, I make a habit of having my animal wait. So we do the thing and then they wait. We do the next step and then they wait. So that they don't get to pushing through this stuff. And you can kind of apply this lesson to, you know, just about anything you're working with your mules. You know, you don't want to just hurry through it all the time. It's easy to put it together because, you know, by me practicing waiting on each little segment of opening that gate with that mule Bobo, you know, if I continue to work on that with him and I made it a habit to wait all the time. Well, when it come down to me wanting just to, if I did want to hurry and open and close the gate, well, it would just take a little encouragement and I could go on through it. Versus trying to hold one back and force them to wait when you have consistently pushed them through and gone too fast and they don't know how to wait. So that's the difference. So, you know, work on things like that. And, you know, I just really enjoyed riding that mule. And I'm really grateful that they brought me a mule like that. You know, a lot of times people will bring me mules that, or, you know, like when I fly to places and I say, hey, I'd like to, you know, I need a mule or I need a horse to use to demo with. And when you say demo with, and I've tried to stop using that word when I tell my hosts things, because when you say demo, they think like, oh, well, let's get a problem animal and then we'll watch you work with this problem. When, you know, the style of my clinics, and if any of you that have been to my clinics, you realize that my clinics are absolutely geared toward you, the student, working with you. I do not come to town just to show you what I can do. I've never appreciated those clinics, you know, myself. When I go watch that kind of stuff, I don't like just seeing what that guy or gal can get done, because that doesn't go far. I don't like showing off what I can do, you know. Any of the things I've been involved in that kind of show off what I can do, you know, with my mules, I didn't really, you know, enjoy them or get a lot out of them myself. And I don't feel like I offered a lot of value to the people there. So I don't like it. So when I ask for a demo animal, what I mean is I want an animal that I can demonstrate these movements and these principles on that I teach. And yeah, if you want to line up a little project to do, otherwise we can do that. But I've had folks line up basically a handful for me. And I'm sitting here trying to teach somebody that is just trying to learn how to ride. They are not there to learn how to handle a mule that is riled up and having all kinds of problems. They're there to learn how to ride and just better themselves. You know, they want to work on simple moves and transitions and these principles that we teach. They don't care about me working on some bronc. Okay, they don't. And I figured that out early on. If you came to one of my clinics back in the day, I would have worked with everybody's animal. If some of you are listening, maybe you were at some of those early clinics back in 2012. That's when I started, 2013. Way back then, if you showed up, I worked all your animals. And you watched. You just sat in a chair and watched. Obviously, that didn't go good because I don't do that anymore. Now you come, you bring your animal. I'll help you to be better. I'm here to help you because I've learned it doesn't matter what I can do, because at the end of the clinic, I'm going home to my mules. And at the end of the clinic, you're going home taking this animal with you. So you need the skills. The student needs the skills. They need the opportunity to get better. And I need to be there to be able to teach them. So my point with that little rabbit hole I just jumped down there is a huge thanks to John and Joe and Dan and Jess and Kaylee. Thank you for letting me use Bobo, because he was just a great animal to demo on. And there were things that I could work on and improve, and people could see that each day. And each day I did a little demonstration at the beginning. And I did do maybe 5 minutes of just going through the checklist. And just so the people could compare each day, okay, what does this mule look like on day one? What does he look like on day two and day three here? And I'll let you kind of do the comparisons. So anyways, Bobo was a great demo mule, and I'm so grateful to be able to use him. So, there's so many things that we can talk about Australia. I was mentioning the sheep and, you know, being here from San Pete County in Utah, sheep are everywhere. This is sheep country. And, this was the, being down there in Australia, I got a weather alert on my phone, and I had never got a weather alert like this. And so I immediately sent it to one of my friends here in town that, he runs a lot of sheep. He's one of the biggest sheep ranchers in Utah. And I sent him this weather warning because it popped up on my phone, you know, like a severe weather. It said, you know, sheep grazers warning. And it was, you know, said from Tuesday to Thursday, whatever. And it goes on to say sheep grazers are warned that cold temperatures, rain and showers, and kind of says where they are. And there's a risk of losses of lambs and sheep exposed to these conditions. And I thought, heck yeah, I am in sheep country now. If I'm getting sheep grazers warnings while I'm out here, this is awesome, because we don't get that in Utah. And Utah is one of the biggest producers of sheep, you know, in the U.S. in the world, you know, right here in Utah, and we don't get sheep grazers warnings. I want that on the weather report, you guys. If somebody's out there listening that can pull the strings, I want to see some sheep grazer warnings. Anyways, that was kind of fun. A lot of you have asked, you know, what does it look like down there? What, you know, I think a lot of you, and me too, pictured, you know, like Quigley Down Under type stuff. You know, a lot of people talk about Crocodile Dundee, and I saw that one time, but I watched Quigley Down Under like multiple times. I've watched Man from Snowy River multiple times. So if you've seen Man from Snowy River, that's like the country we were in. We were in Victoria and New South Wales. So it was that type of terrain, that type of country, hills and stuff like that. When we got up to New South Wales, the clinic was actually in Howlong, New South Wales, which is right on the Murray River, which borders, the Murray River is the border between Victoria and New South Wales. So if you're picturing Australia as desert, yes, most of it is desert, but not where we were. We were, you know, Howlong, New South Wales, it looked a lot like Oklahoma, like I'd say Eastern Oklahoma. So picture a lot of grass, picture a lot of farms, picture a lot of trees, and just instead of, you know, all the cottonwood trees and stuff like that, picture the eucalyptus gum trees, which are really beautiful. They're like, Sky calls them like, what was she call them? Rain, like they look like a rainbow, all different colors. They're really, really pretty. And so picture eucalyptus gum trees and fields, grass, similar to out here too. You know, here in Utah, we got big pivot lines, big pivot irrigation lines, and they make big circles. So there's big, huge crop circles. And they're raising, they call it lucerne. It's just like our alfalfa. They're raising that out there. A lot of black Angus cattle, a lot of black Angus cattle, a lot of Hereford cattle. And you know, Jane Reed that owns Banyanda Naturally. I don't know if I said that Banyanda Naturally. Sorry. Oh my gosh. She had the place, the facility where we did the clinic. Oh my gosh. So beautiful. It is one of my favorite locations. This is our second time doing a clinic there at this particular location. And she runs a bunch of cattle. She got her brother just give her a bunch of weaned heifers called Speckled Park. And they're going to, anybody from Australia that's going to listen to me saying that, I know they're going to laugh right now because they all tease me how I kept saying Speckled Park. I kept saying Spotted Park. And of course, they don't say park like we do. They say park. Anyways, cool looking cows. They're kind of black and white. Don't picture like a Holstein that it's like speckled white. It's pretty cool. So actually on the last day of the clinic, we got to play with the cows, which, I think the people in Mulemanship One, it was kind of a treat for them. We don't ever really get to play with cattle in Mulemanship One. It's usually a Mulemanship Two, and then obviously the cow working classes that get to play with the cows. So it was kind of fun for them. And, anyways, this place, Banyanda Naturally, the arena that we did the clinic in was basically a giant round pen. I don't know what it would measure in feet, just guessing. It'd be like 150 foot by 150 foot, you know, just a big old round pen. And then attached to it was a smaller round pen, like a 60 footer. And beautiful. Oh my gosh. Just so, so beautiful. Picture the round pen, white sand, gorgeous sand in the arena, a nice round pen attached to it. So it's kind of like the shape of an eight, a small little one, then a huge one. And nice corrals. We, you know, they call them yards down there, and beautiful spots for everybody to camp and hang out. She had around here we call it a bunkhouse, but she called it the lighthouse, and had a bunch of rooms. People could stay in the rooms. And Jane took absolute amazing care of me and Sky. We have never eaten that good. She made beautiful healthy food. I mean, it was very good. We had rack of lamb one day and vegetables, and I mean, everything she made tasted good and it was good for you. And she let us stay there at her house, had a nice room for us there and very comfortable. You know, everybody down there was extremely welcoming. And, you know, I just see something in a lot of these people that is a tremendous quality to have, excuse me, a tremendous quality to have in mulemanship and in horsemanship. They're kind people. They're compassionate. They care. And it's interesting to me how this converts into the mulemanship part. You know, I think compassion and being welcoming and the feel that they showed towards Sky and I being there as guests, you know, they show that to their equine too, to their mules, to their horses, to their donkeys. And in the clinic, we had mules, horses, and donkeys, which is great. Australia has always been the most diverse clinic for sure when it comes to equine. We got a lot of horses, a lot of mules. We had a couple of donkeys this time. And but just showing that, you know, that feel, I guess it's probably hard for me to explain here in words to you what I'm trying to, you know, what I'm thinking here, what I'm trying to say. But, you know, that welcomeness that they portrayed to Sky and I, you know, they also portray that to their animals. And I could see that. And I wish more people would do that. You know, and that's a good question for all of us to ask. You know, do our horses and mules and donkeys, do they feel welcome being around us? Like, do they enjoy it? Do they also feel that we enjoy them being around? And like us being there in Australia, I can say with absolute certainty that they all enjoyed me and Sky being around. They liked having us there. They enjoyed us. And they made that known and they made that felt. And if we can take that same lesson and apply it to our mulemanship and our horsemanship, I think we'd all be way better off. And they absolutely were just so welcoming and we could all take a lesson from that. So getting to the clinic a little bit, poor Sky. I say poor Sky, but it was also a nice vacation, I guess, for her. But you know, she didn't have anything to ride, and she didn't really have anything to work with there. So she kind of just hung out, and I think she spent the majority of her time looking at birds. Sky loves all the birds down there. So do I. She loves the birds. She was on an absolute mission to record kookaburra. And also the Australians will make fun of me for how I say that, but the kookaburra, she wanted to record their call, whatever. And cause it sounds pretty neat. And she did get it. She found one, she recorded the call. So if you're on her social media, you can hear that kookaburra or just look it up and you can hear what they sound like, but really cool birds. They got all kinds of gorgeous birds, parrots and what are they called? Cockatoos and just all kinds of neat. Even their magpies, like our magpie here in the U.S. is, I don't know, like maybe it sounds rude. It's just not the prettiest bird, you know, like nobody really, I mean, I don't know anybody that appreciates a magpie, you know, we're mostly annoyed by them around here. And, you know, speaking of sheep, the magpies, you know, they really annoy the lambs, you know, when they're born and even calves. Even their magpies are pretty down there. And, you know, of course, just like us, you know, I don't really appreciate our magpie. They don't really appreciate their magpie either, but I will say that even the magpie is more beautiful than we got. And while we were there, you know, doing the clinic or while I was doing the clinic rather, yes, I was just out looking for birds and I was just doing my thing. And I got to say, holy cow, this clinic went by so fast. It was a very easy clinic to teach. These students here, they really wanted to learn. They showed so much enthusiasm. And I don't know if it's just because of a little scarcity. I mean, you know, the last time we were there was 2019 and we haven't been able to come back. And, you know, they really wanted us to come back. They really appreciated us. And it felt really good to end our 2023 clinic year, our 2023 clinic tour, you know, our last clinic, to feel so welcomed and so appreciated. And they did a really good job of that, which is another great mealmanship lesson. You know, like I know they appreciated me in Sky coming down there. I know they appreciated us. And just another thing to think about, like, does your mule know that you appreciate them? No, seriously, does it know? I'm not trying to anthropomorphize this deal. I'm not trying to make them have human feelings or feel human feelings, but I know mules appreciate things. They appreciate feed and they appreciate good water and they appreciate rest and, you know, they do appreciate going for rides too. But does your mule know that you appreciate them? Because there's a feel to that. Like, I mean, these people in Australia, they really made me feel that way. You know, there's a lot of clinics that I have left thinking, and even clinics this year in 2023 that I left thinking, oh my gosh. I don't think any of them, you know, got anything from me. I don't know that any of them appreciated me even being here, you know, and it's easy to get those feelings of doubt creeping in, you know, and it's not a great feeling. You all know what I mean. You've all been there. And I felt it, but not down there in Australia. It was one of the very first clinics. Maybe it is the first that every single participant and the majority of the spectators came up and said, thank you, and shook my hand and looked me in the eye and said, thank you for being here. Are you coming back? You know, thank you for being here. Are you coming back? That was the common thing. they just loved it. Does your mule feel that way? Like, Do you show that type of enthusiasm, that type of appreciation to your mule? You know, I don't know that I do. I probably ought to be more appreciative. There's a lot of times that, you know, went out, rode, worked, you know, especially working cows, you go kind of use them and strip your saddle off and brush them off and put them away. And it's kind of business as is. I don't know that the mule feels, you know, too appreciated. I'm not saying not to work them. I'm just saying, like, I wonder what the feel is. I wonder what kind of feel I have portrayed to the animal. And this is me just rambling, you guys, on some of these thoughts. And I hope it kind of wets your brain a little bit and gets you thinking. But anyways, they were amazing. You know, there's all kinds of experiences that we had there with different animals and people. You know, they're really getting into quality breeding down there. They got a lot of good jacks, or I shouldn't say a lot. They got a few good jacks, and they're starting to really get into paying attention to the mares, and their mules are getting better and better. We had multiple youngsters in the foundation class, some beautiful mules, just some really beautiful mules. And, you know, just quality built. They look good. You know, they're going to grow up and just be great riding animals. And, you know, they're so, the people there, they were so interested in learning, you know, a lot of them took notes, you know, right in class. And it's, and especially these people with the youngsters, they really wanted to know, okay, how do I raise these things up? What should I be working on? What should I be focusing on? What should I be doing? They wanted to know details, like, okay, when they're this old, what do you kind of do? And when they're about this old, what do you kind of do there? A lot of breeders were there. They wanted to know information on, you know, my experience on the best, you know, techniques and the best practices for weaning. You know, how can we wean them with less stress? You know, how can we wean them with less trauma? And because, you know, a lot of our mules are weaned these days, and it's kind of a big traumatic experience for them. And these mules kind of pack this wean trauma And if you don't know what I'm talking about, if you're thinking, well, I don't know what he's talking about. Okay, every herd-bound mule out there, you know, every herd-bound mule, it seems like they have some, you know, I look at how they were raised, how they were weaned, and, you know, I got one mule particularly that, you know, basically she was weaned. I picked her up, took her off the mom, took her home. That's how she was weaned. And she is one of the most herd-bound mules I've ever had. Well, because I think she had a lot of trauma being weaned, you know, and I'm not saying it's trauma that's going to affect her like in a whole bunch of different ways. I'm just saying that I think the herd bound is related to that. And so these people were really concerned about best practices. And, you know, granted, I haven't raised near as many mules as a lot of even my listeners. I'm sure a lot of you have raised way more mules than I have. You know, so for me, it's not really the baby experience that I have to offer. I have the older, what does this look like when they're 2 and 3? You know, colt starting, that's my number one experience. And then, you know, it's getting to be these days more with problem solving later on with older mules. That's what I deal with mostly in the clinics. And so anyways, these people really wanted to learn and it was neat. But we had all kinds in the clinic. You know, there was one particular yearling that the first day, this little guy was just all over the lady that brought him. I mean, just all over, like just totally pushing her around. And so I worked with the person and I wanted her to know that she can move the mule, because the mule had definitely, this youngster had definitely figured out that he could move her. And I said, okay, before you work on all these things about moving the hinds and moving the fronts and all these particular moves, even before you teach him to lead, even before that, before you do all this other stuff, can you just get this animal to yield to you? Yield away from you, rather. Can you just get this thing to move off of you, like so you can send it any just somewhere? And that was the first thing we worked on. And it's amazing, you guys, how quick these animals can pick up on that. Whether you can move them and cause movement in their feet away from you, or if they can cause movement from you, it is so crazy how quick these babies pick up on that. Like a lot of these people down there, they said, okay, what's just some advice with these babies when you're in there with, when they're with the mother, when they're weaned and so forth, what's just some advice? And I said, don't let that baby figure out that it moves your feet. Like, don't, if it gets to where it's like, oh, I can kind of move your feet. Now, I'm not talking about them trying to draw to you and trying to seek some connection. I'm talking about when they figured out how to move you around, like moving one horse off of a hay pile, you know, how to push them off a hay pile. That's what I'm talking about. And it's amazing how quick these babies figured it out. And this baby had figured it out. I said, okay, before we do any of the moves, forget the moves right now. Don't worry about all this other groundwork checklist. Forget it. I want you to cause this animal to move away from you. I don't even care which way. I don't care which direction. I don't care where you go. I want this animal to move away from you. I says, what are you going to do? And, you know, what she would go to drive him, but like she'd pick up her flag or something to go to kind of drive him off of the flag. But as she's waving the flag, she's walking backwards. We had to stop that. You can't do that. No, you don't need to be walking backwards. The mule needs to move away from you. And so the first day we took a chunk of time and just worked on getting that youngster to move off of her. After she could cause some movement, after that baby could move away, then we can start working on these different pieces. Because what happened is, you know, we start the foundation class and the very first step we teach, the very first piece that you, the first physical move, I should say, that you work on in one of my foundation classes is clearing the front. Okay, well, this lady couldn't even cause movement, let alone directed movement. So there's always, you can always slice these steps down into smaller and smaller pieces. So that was the first thing. Just get the meal to move. I don't care which way, back, forward, left or right, as long as it's not towards you and on you and pushing you. Get it to yield away from you. And she did that. And the second day, it was interesting watching her how much quicker things clicked along. Once that meal learned to move away from her, then when she added in some direction, it came together much better. And it was interesting seeing their behavior. By the third day, she could stand there with that baby. And that baby was standing still comfortably. Where the first day, that baby was everywhere, all over, pushing her, moving her, you know, trying to, you know, kind of walk around everywhere. By day three, it was standing next to her on a loose rein, relaxed. So impressive. Just so impressive. And, you know, it's not just about the moves. If you do the moves just to do the moves, I mean, I guess you're getting a little value. At least you can do something. But I do these moves, and we do these maneuvers in the clinic so that we can communicate and be understood. Not just communicate by itself, but communicate and be understood by the animal. I want this communication to be both ways here. I want to understand what they are doing, and I want them to understand what I'm doing. One of the biggest connections I'm trying to make happen in a clinic, or trying to get to take place, is the person realizing and noticing and being aware of what the mule is doing. So I use these moves to connect the dots. Like the very first move I mentioned, clearing the front. Okay, where do you want that left front foot to go? And I get the person thinking about putting that foot there. That kind of awareness, that kind of connection makes a wonderful pipeline for communication between you and your animal, because you're paying attention to where they are, what they're doing, what they're feeling. You ask them a question, you notice and you're aware of how they respond or maybe react to that question, and then you can analyze that. And like Tom Dorrance said, you know, observe, remember, and compare. And, you know, so I think a lot of this stuff, we're quick to notice the mules and the horses and the donkeys making changes. But I think we need to acknowledge way more often the people making the changes. The people need to, you know, be acknowledged, because that's pretty neat to me. There's more. I got a whole list here of experiences that I want to kind of share with everybody. The next one is about my buddy Rob and his mule Holly. So Rob and Holly, I actually got to help Rob put his first ride on Holly when I was there 4 years ago. Okay. Well, time flies quick, and apparently, you know, my buddy didn't have a whole lot of time to work this mule. And, you know, I'm not going to share all the details. Long story short, he didn't really work with this mule much at all in the last 4 years since I was there. And, so he brought Holly, he really wanted some help. And what was interesting to me was when he would ask this mule for anything, the mule would just kick out. And this can definitely be intimidating. I mean, for a lot of you listening, I'm sure this might be intimidating. Put yourself in his position. You go to pick up on the rein, ask the mule to bend, the mule kicks. You put your leg on, ask the mule to move a hip over, it kicks. You ask the mule to go forward, it kicks out. And, you know, that's not very fun. Nobody wants to do that. So what are we going to do about that? Holy cow, right? So Rob, the first day of the clinic, you know, he did some groundwork. He used the mule in the foundation class. And then, you know, that all went good and everything. And he did his homework that night, which, but another thing, I got to just jump in real quick and give a shout out to all the Australians doing their stinking homework. Good job. Like, I give homework out at every clinic, and man, they all went out and they did it. They were all awesome. They all went out there and actually practiced. So good job to you guys. They took me serious on that, and I appreciate it. It definitely shows your willingness to learn. And anyway, so Rob did his homework for sure. Day two uses Holly in the foundation class again, and she's doing really good in the foundation, you guys. I mean, she's nailing it. She's doing the moves. I did have to have Rob slow things down and turn things down a little bit, because what was happening is she was doing the moves fine, but her expression was really poor. Her ears were back. She definitely had a sour expression as he's asking her to move. And so what I had him work on was his signal, making his signals smaller and doing less. So instead of coming in there so bold and I don't know all the vocabulary words I should be using, but kind of bold and quick and tough, like coming in there much, much lighter. And so, because I, even as he'd pick up his hand to ask her to go one way or the other, she'd get a sour expression. So I said, I want you to barely lift up your hand to go to the right, just barely. And he lifted up real quiet and smooth. And I said, don't use your flag. Don't try to drive her yet. Just wait there. And it was interesting because she knew to go. It was interesting. I noticed the less that he did, and he slowed things down, and he didn't go in there so aggressive or abrasive, that mule really cooled off. And you know, you can kind of just compare it to, you know, if somebody just bosses you around, tells you what to do all the time, you do kind of get a sour taste about it, right? You don't, if you work for somebody, let's put it in that perspective. If you work for somebody and your employer just tells you what to do all the time, you probably don't like them. If we're being honest, you're probably, you know, like, geez, this guy's kind of a jerk. I mean, you work there so you can get your paycheck type of thing. And it's easy to get in that same way with our mules, where we just talk at them and we just tell them what to do and we just boss them around. And then we wonder why they have a little bit of a sour expression. Now I'm not trying to paint my buddy Rob in any negative way, because I love Rob. I mean, he's over there in Australia, but I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I could probably call Rob and say, hey buddy, I need some help. Can you fly over here? And you know, I probably have to buy his plane ticket, but he would come do it. Like, he's that type of a guy. Like, he's an incredible guy, and he is really good hand with these mules. But I think sometimes we can get in a routine. We can kind of get to where working mules is a little bit of a job, and we're just kind of cranking away at the moves, and we're not really considering as much about how the mule feels until it is bothering us. Like, until this mule started pinning your ears, you know, well, it's not a big deal until then. Well, now it bothers us, right? So we have to be aware of these things and pay attention to these things. And for this particular case, I just had him slow way, way down, like just shutter way down. And that made a big difference. And I think that helped him, because that evening on day two, he wanted a little help putting a ride on her. And so we went out to the arena and he got warmed up, did his groundwork, and stepped up on her. She's great to get on, you know, no trouble there. She stood nice. And then we just started working through the checklist. And I said, okay, this is our objective here. We're just going to kind of work through the checklist. And so very methodically, we just worked one little piece at a time. The first step, so standstill to mount, check. Then lateral flexion both ways, measured. And this was another thing that we had to work on a little bit, because it's easy. I think a lot of people are, when it comes to asking the mule to bend left or right, their first thought is just to bend it around until their head's bent around, you know, to 90 degrees or even past 90, which, you know, if any of you have been to one of my clinics, you know that we don't bend the mule past 90. There's no reason to. In fact, there's very few reasons to even go past 45 degrees. So a lot of us just bend them around with no thought. And I said, I want you to just measure, just barely tip her nose. And when he'd go to do that, she'd just walk off. And she'd be just a little sour walking off. And all we did for a good chunk of time was work on just asking the mule to bend left or right, barely tipping the nose off center, and just seeing if the mule could just stand there, because it wasn't connecting. The animal, you pick up on the rein and the mule just wants to walk off. I want the mule to know what piece of the body I'm talking to. And I want them to either, you know, I want the rein to either connect to a foot or not. So either I'm turning a foot on or I'm turning it off. That's it. And this mule thought that by me picking up on the, or by Rob picking up on the rein, it meant turn the feet on, move. So we worked on that for a little while. And then we got to the first method. So the next step would be the first method of moving the hindquarters, which is rein and leg. So you'd ask the mule to bend off center, you know, maybe say you bend them to the right a little ways. And then you'd apply your right leg back in third gear. That's near the rear cinch. And your objective is to get the mule to step its hindquarters to the left, moving away from your leg, away from your rein. And so that's the objective. But he would just, I mean, barely set his leg on there, and that mule was just kicking out. And I said, okay, I want you to just barely touch that leg on there. I need you to keep the bend on the rein and do not take your leg off. I don't care if she's how much she's kicking. Don't take your leg off until she gives you some type of attempt to yield. Even if it's just even if she just kind of walks forward, anything. I want her to realize that a leg, if she can move some way, then I'm going to release that. So basically we're just rewarding for the move we want, and we are ignoring what we don't want. You know, and this is where a lot of people ask me questions like, well, what do you do about them kicking? Are you going to punish them? What are you going to do? I'm not going to do anything. So when this animal's kicking out, I'm going to do nothing. All I'm going to do is let my leg, and when I'm talking like so little, I mean, he barely had his pants touching the mule's side. I mean, pressure is so minimal here, but anything would set this mule off. So he did that until he caught some movement, and then he just released, and then the mule would kind of walk off, and we weren't too worried about trying to get it just to stand there. So we just kept on repeating this until finally that mule would take a step and got to where it could just stand there. And that's when we finally started to get down to the good stuff, because if we could get that mule to yield and then just stand there, then we could let it soak a little bit. Now, you can let them soak by moving too, and we basically did, but it's better if they can just stop. And this is where the magic happened. When that finally happened, maybe 5 minutes into the work, that mule just went, oh, just a big breath, and started licking its lips. Its eyes got quiet, and it absolutely went to the, as Rob said, mule went to the drugstore. It got some good stuff straight to the pharmacy, and it was feeling good. It finally got some good dopamine, some good serotonin going in there. And that's what we want. And it was amazing. Once we could get that first soak time in, once we got that first opportunity to let the mule pause and self-regulate, oh, it was a piece of cake from there. All the rest of the pieces were so easy. We just had to hang in there. You got to stay with it until you can finally get that good moment of self-regulating, that soak time, all that good science stuff we're talking about in the clinics all the time. Once we get that, oh man, it was so easy. And, you know, Rob was so grateful. I mean, like I said, again, these people are just amazing, and they're grateful, and they're so happy to have help. And he was absolutely grateful. He said thanks about 500 times. You know, the next morning he got another little ride on the mule and it went good. And I said, how'd it go? And he said, oh, we went straight to the drugstore, mate. You know, that made me so happy, you know, I was there to help Rob. Absolutely. I mean, I always tell you, I'm there to help the people. But it's also really fun, you guys, being able to help a mule find that comfort, helping them find that opportunity to feel good about what you're doing. But, you know, you got to, sometimes you got to slow stuff down. So that was really a highlight as well, was Rob and Holly. You know, there's so many, there's some really funny moments. You know, Anna, picture a lady with the biggest smile and just so happy, just a positive, a positivity radiating off of her. That is Anna. She's just a sweetheart. And she had a donkey named Radar. And oh, Radar, he just thought the sand was the most wonderful thing in the world too. He just thought this sand was so wonderful. And he just wanted to roll and scratch in it. And he felt so good. And he'd roll and lay down there. And he'd feel like taking a nap. You know, he was just feeling good. And it's like, okay, you know, all right. We got to do a little bit more than this, Radar. So, you know, she'd have to flag him up. And anyways, it was a continual kind of a funny deal about Anna and Radar. Radar always wanted to take a nap. So that was kind of funny. I could probably go on and on, you know, and talk about different people and their animals. You know, another highlight was Anita and her mule Shamus. Anita had a bit of a wreck about 10 months ago, and she hadn't really ridden Shamus in 10 months. And, you know, the first day she comes to Mulemanship 1, and she's just kind of doing a bunch of groundwork, which is fine. That's fine. I tell everybody, come to class early, do your groundwork, and be in the saddle when I get here so we can start riding, you know, on time for Mulemanship 1. Well, she was doing her groundwork in there. And I said, how do you feel, Anita? You know, she's pretty honest. I feel nervous. I'm kind of nervous. I knew that. I just wanted to hear what she would say. And I said, well, your mule looks good. And Shamus did look good. He was calm. You could tell he was feeling fine. There was nothing hidden in there. No hidden anxiety, no trouble. You know, he was putting it out there for me. And I could see that. I said, Anita, go ahead and get on. And so she said, yes, sir. She got on. And I really appreciate that too, you know, because, you know, I have that experienced eye where I can look out there and I can see when the mule is ready to go or not, ready to move or not, ready to do the next step or not. And, you know, I don't know if Anita listens to this podcast or not, but I want her to know how much I appreciate her faith in me and her faith in this process. You know, it was really good. It was really good. And, anyways, so she started that. She had not ridden Shamus in 10 months. Started that clinic. By the end of the clinic, she was playing around with the cattle. She was going through transitions, was doing everything, looking really good. So I'm very proud of her. I'm proud of her for stepping it up like that. And I know she was scared. I know she was nervous. And I know a lot of you feel the same way in situations. You know, and a lot of you have been to my clinic and you can feel for Anita, you know, you had a wreck and it's kind of scary getting back on. I mean, just face the facts. It is, right? And kudos to all of you that saddle up, step it up and push on. And I'm not saying to do something too early. I'm not saying the same thing as just saddle up, get back on. You know, just get back on again and ride. I'm not saying that. I'm saying good job to those of you that go through the process. You check on things, you work on things, you get yourself going, you get your mind right, you work on your mule, your horse, your donkey, you get them right. When it's time, you take a step up. And that was it. I saw that Anita, she was on the edge of being ready. It seemed like she was almost ready, pretty darn close. I feel like if I would have given her excuse and said, oh, don't get on today, I think she would have totally took that too. But her response to me told me everything I needed to know. Like I said, I saw the mule was ready. So check the box for him. I know he's good to go. I'm not worried about her having any issues with him. That box is checked. Me checking the box for her was saying, hey, how you feel? Well, I'm nervous. So she was honest. And I said, get on. She said, yes, sir. Okay. Box checked. She's ready to get on. Like I said, I could have easily given her an out and said, oh, don't ride today. And I think she would have said yes to that too, but she was willing. She said yes. So good job. And some of you need that out there. Some of you need that help. And I hope to be there for you to do that. So, you know, another little thing I want to shout out there. You know, you've all heard it. It's a small world, right? It's just a small world. And April, one of the participants down there, she had an older mule there that she was working through some issues, but one day she brought her dad along. And this was kind of a treat for me too. This is another one of the highlights, but her dad is Neil Harvey, and he is a incredible rawhide breeder in Australia. Now down in Australia, they don't get a lot of this traditional buckaroo gear like we have, you know, all over out here. And so I get to meet Neil Harvey, and we get to chatting and talking a little bit, and come to find out, you know, he's friends with Tom Peterson, and I've mentioned Tom Peterson on here. He's been on the podcast. You know, he's an incredible rawhide breeder here in Ephraim, Utah. I mean, if you want good gear here in the States, good rawhide gear, Tom Peterson is your man. He's awesome. And if you're down in Australia, I have to absolutely give a shout out to Neil Harvey. He brought a bunch of his gear, a bunch of his Bozzells and some others, you know, some head stalls and some things. And if you guys want good gear down there, you need to look up Neil Harvey. Amazing rawhide braider. Did really good. Does really good work. So that was fun. Anyways, clinic was amazing. You know, just fun all around. Great people. A lot of learners. It was a record for our spectator attendance. Usually, you know, I mean, I don't count the expos for spectator attendance because those are in the thousands. So I don't count those. But I'm talking about just a regular clinic like this. Usually, I mean, if we get 10 spectators a day, I'm not including other participants. I'm not including their like spouses and kids and stuff. I'm talking about people that just showed up to pay to spectate and audit the clinic. This was a record. We had a whole, as the Australians would say, heaps of them, heaps of people there watching. And you know, it was fun to see all them out there enjoying the clinic and learning and so interested in learning. I mean, everybody's taking notes and actually learning. You know, I hope you have realized this, but when you come to my clinics, I'm really not there to entertain you. I'm there to inspire you and to share my experience with you. That's what I'm there for. And so when I see people out there taking notes, heck yeah, that's what I'm there for. That's what I'm there for, you guys. I'm there to save you time and to inspire you and to share that experience. So that's pretty cool to me. So good job. Anyways, it was kind of a quick deal after that. We had to hurry immediately after and jump in the ute, not jump in the truck, remember, jump in the ute and head home. Dan and Jess was taking us home. Well, taking us back to their house and then on to the airport hotel. But, you know, Dan may kill me for sharing this. He might very well kill me. But Jess will think I'm a hero. So what I'm about to share with you, Jess is going to love it. Dan's going to hate it. But so we're heading home. We stop at the servo, you know, the what we would call a gas station or a fuel stop or whatever, you know, a truck stop. That's what we'd call it, right? They call it a servo. We stop at the servo and get some grub and actually McDonald's again. And Dan gave us a hard time about that. But we got some grub for a minute. We were in a hurry. And anyways, we pull out from the servo back onto the Hewn Highway there and the fuel light comes on. And Dan's like, oh no, we're good. The fuel light, it only comes on. It's wrong. It's not correct. Whatever. We got plenty. We can get down here to the next stop. And anyways, we're not getting far at all. And the check engine light comes on and then it derates the power. And next thing you know, it just shuts us right off. And you know, we're thinking, well, usually when it runs out of fuel, it kind of sputters and spits and we kind of just, you know, kind of come to a clunky stop, but it just shut off. So we're thinking, oh crap, maybe something else is up. And but Jess is adamant. She's like, "You ran out of fuel," and she was just harassing poor Dan. And you know, I'll give Dan this. You know, he didn't say any swear words, and I was really impressed, because if I break down, boy, it's I'm not happy. I'm not necessarily swearing, but I'm not happy at all. And old Dan held it in, and I think he was just holding it in for us. That's it. He knew that we're not into all that swearing and cussing and stuff, and he held it in pretty darn good. So he called service guy, and he called his friend, and this is impressive to me. He called his neighbor. Another life lesson and another mealmanship lesson right here. See, I can make analogies every which way. He called his neighbor, the one where I went fishing. And sure enough, Brad shows up. He brings some fuel just in case. And they're thinking, well, if they're broke down, like if this is going to have to get towed off, then, we're going to, hook the float onto his ute, and then they're going to take me to the airport and blah, 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 blah. You know, we got all these details to work out. But he brings a can of fuel and dumps it in. And Dan is like, I would rather this be a $6,000 repair than me running out of fuel. I've never run out of fuel in my life. And Jess is just harassing him. And me and Sky are trying to stay out of it. Anyways, so he's like, well, I kind of hope it starts, but I kind of hope it doesn't start. And so he goes to fire it up, and oh, sure enough, it fires right up. And we ran out of fuel. That's all it was. And Jess was just harassing him the whole way home. Oh man. And so I was trying to stick up for him. But anyways, it ended up being, that burned up quite a bit of time. We made it home back to their house, and then he took us on to the airport, long drive for him and everything, and just grateful. But back to his neighbor, this is a lesson right here. Back to his neighbor. He called his neighbor. His neighbor said, "You bet, I'll be there." And his neighbor drove all that way to come bring some fuel and to come help. I want to be a neighbor like that. See, I didn't say I want to have a neighbor like that, although, I would. I would definitely like to have some neighbors like that. And I do. I do have some neighbors like that that I could call and they would come help. But I hope I am that type of a neighbor, that type of a friend. Can others rely on me? Is that the type of person I am? Makes me think a little bit. Makes me want to be better. Makes me want to do better. It really does. Tying it into mules. Can our mules rely on us like that? When our mules are in trouble, are we the ones that they can rely on to come help them? You might not be able to put it in perspective. Let me help you. Because you might not think of it the way I'm thinking of it here. You're riding down the trail and your mule's scared of a stump. Are you there to help your mule through that? Are you going to help with the problem, or are you part of the problem? I hope you're there to help with the problem. I hope they can rely on you. Anyways, we had a good flight home, made it home, got the mule and the pony picked up, got the kids picked up, and it was good to be home. It was way too fast of a trip for that long of a flight, though. We weren't on the ground long enough, but amazing trip. To all of my Australian friends down there, thank you for an incredible clinic. What a highlight. What a great way to end our 2023 clinic tour. What an amazing way to do it. What an amazing year we had. This has been our best year ever. And it's because of all the great people out there like you guys, all the wonderful people. Thank you so much, every one of you. If you guys would be kind enough, if you enjoyed this episode and if you enjoy our other episodes, if you would be willing to leave me a review. I'd love to see the 5 stars on there and love to see your comments there if you wouldn't mind doing that. Or you can always shoot me an email. Send the email to me, ty@tsmules.com. That's ty@tsmules.com. I'd love to hear your feedback about these podcasts. So, hey, thank you so much for listening. God bless you, and we'll see you down the road.